Chapter 23. More Balkan Intrigue. Italy's entry into the war was no more than a small beginning. After Italy, some 20 other countries would be snared in the trap set out by Messrs. Poincaré and Asquith. Meanwhile, the Germans and the Austrians, on their guard, had won over another Balkan country, Bulgaria. Bulgaria's strategic position was important. If she entered on the side of the Germans, she would immediately assure them and the Austrians contact with their new allies, the Turks. On the other hand, if she swung to the side of the Allies, she could be the decisive base for the offensive of the Russians against Constantinople, their chief objective. She could form a geographical link for the armies of the Tsar with those of Serbia, their satellite in the Balkans. The idea of having an additional adversary, one the size of Bulgaria at their throat, was bound to cause enormous worry to the Russians, who had been somewhat relieved by Italy's entry into the war. Bulgaria was thus, for friends and enemies alike, a country whose collaboration seemed essential. Bulgaria's leaders knew it. In August 1914, the country at first stayed quietly in its corner. Officially, Bulgaria remained neutral. It was a time to see who would offer the most. Just as Sannino had done on behalf of Italy, and as the Romanians, who would be the last to decide, would do. The Bulgarians coldly calculated the advantages offered them by the rival bidders. They felt themselves to be Slavs. But they also had the blood of Mongols and Turks in their veins, and crossbred as they were with Greeks and even Germans, they were now for Constantinople and now against her. One of their kings had married the daughter of the Byzantine emperor, but then again, Basil II, called the Killer of Bulgarians, had taken 15,000 of them prisoners and pulled out their eyes as casually as if he were going through their pockets, 900 years before. And Bulgars have long memories. In October of 1912, Hartwig, the Russian ambassador in Belgrade, had organized the First Balkan War. He had launched the Greeks, the Montenegrins, the Serbs, and the Bulgarians in an assault on the decrepit Turks. The Bulgarians flattened the Turks at Kirkkilis, at Lule Burgas, and finally at Adrianople. They approached the minarets of Constantinople. That was too much for the Tsar of Russia. King Ferdinand of Bulgaria was not an unpretentious person. Just like his great patron in St. Petersburg, he dreamed of capturing the capital of the Bosphorus and of proclaiming himself emperor there. Of course, that wouldn't do at all for the Tsar. Constantinople was a Russian monopoly, a fief that the Tsar had reserved for himself. The Serbians, too, were seized by jealousy to see that there were now two strong countries in the Balkans, when they definitely intended that there should never be more than one, their own. The result was the Treaty of London in May 1913, which legalized Bulgaria's conquests. It had hardly been signed when the Second Balkan War broke out in June, the following month. All the peoples between the Danube and the Aegean Seas had been whipped up by the Russian government, and they fell on ambitious Bulgaria tooth and nail. The Romanians, the Greeks, the Montenegrins, the Serbs, descended upon Bulgaria. Even the Turks, who had been the common enemy a year earlier, joined in. The Bulgarians were easily defeated. In August 1913, the Treaty of Bucharest stripped them nearly to the skin. In the west, the Serbians took Macedonia, the Romanians took Dobruja from Bulgaria in the north, and in the south the Bulgarians had to surrender to the Turks Adrianople, the Hadrianopolis of 2,000 years ago, founded by Hadrian, the native of Seville who had become emperor of Rome. After that beating, Bulgaria, however completely Slav she might be, no longer harbored feelings of solidarity, but rather enmity, towards the Serbians, who had wasted no time carrying out frightful massacres of the Macedonians, no sooner than they had been wrested from their union with the Bulgarians. As for the Russian leaders, they had allowed Bulgaria to be nearly annihilated to assure their own claims on Constantinople. Bulgaria no longer saw them as protectors, but as dangerous enemies. The British and French governments wished to block without fail an alliance of Germany and Turkey, which would unite their enemies from the border of Denmark clear to the heart of Asia Minor, where British interests were dominant. Winning over Bulgaria appealed to everybody because she had become militarily strong, the nation had at its disposal 500,000 soldiers who were generally known to be very good fighters. To convince Bulgaria, however, the Allies would have to guarantee absolutely the restitution of the regions that the Romanians and the Serbians had taken the year before. The French politicians favored this approach. It was easier to give away what belonged to others. Macedonia was not Alsace. With France, then, Bulgaria could easily come to an agreement, at the expense of her neighbors, as we learn from the confidential telegram of the French embassy in Bulgaria, dated November 19, 1914, number 99 of the archives of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Paris. Bulgaria is ready to grant us her complete assistance in exchange for guaranteeing her the acquisition of Thrace as far as the Enos-Midia line and the return of all the Macedonian regions, possession of which had been promised her by the Serbo-Bulgarian Treaty of March 13, 1912. By any reckoning, those restitutions cost the French less than a bottle of Calvados. But the Serbians? And the Romanians? And the Russians? The Russian government demanded Constantinople as their chief war compensation, which Bulgaria also coveted. The interests of the Bulgarians and the Russians were in absolute conflict. On the other hand, the Serbians were unconditional supporters of the Russians. They were the battering ram the Panslavs meant to drive into the southern flank of the Austrians. It was thanks to the Serbians and partially for the Serbians that the Russians, after the double crime of Sarajevo, triggered the European War. How could they dismantle the Serbian bastion for the benefit of the Bulgarians, their direct rivals on the Bosphorus? No matter. The Russian Panslavs could no longer afford the luxury of playing swashbucklers. They were in dire straits. The Germans had trounced them severely. Their commander-in-chief, Grand Duke Nicholas, feeling lost, clamored for the intervention of other countries, Italy to start with, as we have seen. His Minister of War was sending him scarcely a quarter of the artillery shells his batteries at the front needed if they were to avoid annihilation. "I ask for trainloads of ammunition and they send me trainloads of priests," the Grand Duke sneered. He would plainly prefer the Bulgarians to the priests. But Sazonov blocked everything. At a pinch he would accept some partial retrocessions in Macedonia, telegraphed Ambassador Paleolog, who remained very cautious. M. Sazonov had just put forth some other diplomatic plans. Promising King Ferdinand some partial retrocessions was not very much, especially since the Germans were in a position to promise a good deal more. It wouldn't cost them a pfennig to offer the Bulgarians the return of so oft-partitioned Macedonia. Paris, impatient, prodded the Russians mercilessly. The Russian Panslavs decided to make the Bulgarians an offer, subject to acceptance by the Serbians. It was plain that the Serbian answer would be no. Old Pašić hadn't covered up the Sarajevo killings and provoked the War of 1914 just to go soft for the benefit of his enemy of 1913. At the beginning of the negotiations of August 10, 1914, he had telegraphed his embassy in Paris, "Serbia didn't go to war three times in the last 2 years to bring about consequences which would make Bulgaria the dominant power in the Balkans. She prefers anything to such a humiliation." Months went by and Bulgaria, despite everything, remained fairly well disposed to the Entente. But how to convince the stubborn Serbians? France and Russia made a joint representation to Pašić. The only answer they would receive was a flat refusal: "Not one centimeter of Macedonia will become Bulgarian so long as I can prevent it." In these negotiations Russia played a strange role. She let the Serbs know that she was not a participant in the French démarche, and that though constrained and forced into it, in reality she disapproved the granting of any concession to the Bulgarians. If the Tsarist clique paid lip service to it today, tomorrow it would do its best to destroy the agreement. On March 4, 1915, the Tsar declared to his Minister of War, "My decision is made, Thrace and the city of Constantinople must be incorporated into the empire." Telegram from Paleolog, number 361. Paris multiplied her promises in vain. The French swore that what Serbia abandoned in Macedonia she would recover 100 times over on the Adriatic, the same gift Paris was offering to the Italians. The Serbs, sly and mistrustful, did not wish to consider concessions to Bulgaria until after they had wrested from Austria all the booty they were demanding. No concession to Bulgaria relative to Macedonia will ever be considered by us before we have achieved the sum total of our aspirations at Austria's expense. Hašek, December 23, 1914. It was useless, therefore, for the Allies to prolong a discussion that was falling on deaf ears. To insist would be to risk offending Serbia with no chance of success. Poincaré, L'Invasion, page 514. The verbosity of the Serbians would grow ever more extravagant. They would grandiloquently propose to charge right through the territory of the troublesome Bulgarians. "We are prepared," Hašek asserted, "to occupy Bulgarian territory and thus destroy the military forces of Sofia." When some months later Hašek found himself with his backside in the waters of the Adriatic, it would be because he had asked for it. Having been thus spurned, it was inevitable that the Bulgarians would side with the Germans. On August 1, 1915, Colonel Gantschers brought the Bulgarians everything they had lost and more besides. They even saw to it that there was liberal bribery in Sofia, because the Balkan negotiators, as we know, always waged the noble war of right with purer hearts when it was paid for in cold cash. The Bulgarian finance minister, M. Tuchev, had already accepted, with eyes half closed, a little Berlin gratuity of 4 million gold marks. This very important leader helped the Germans relieve themselves of a bit of their financial surplus. Such little gifts aided comprehension. The Germans and Bulgarians understood each other better and better. The pleasant comedy of neutrality went on for another month. At the end of September 1915, the German Marshal von Mackensen, a death's head hussar, whose high black kepi with skull and plume still occupied a place of honor at his estate in the neighborhood of Stettin, from which, in April 1945, I directed our battle for the Oder, mustered 10 splendid German divisions south of the Danube. They would be supported by 4 Austro-Hungarian divisions. The vice was closing. Could the Allies not see it? On the Austrian front, the Italian intervention had only led to mediocre results. It had been necessary to transfer only 2 Austro-Hungarian divisions from the Galician front to the defense of the mountains of the Tyrol. The Italians had 312 battalions at their disposal, the Austrians 147. Nevertheless, Austrian losses were limited to a few villages and a few support points. Grand Duke Nicholas, who had counted on the avalanche of 37 Italian divisions to greatly relieve his front, found himself in a worse state than ever. The Russian front had been penetrated at Gorlitz on May 4, 1915, and driven back to the San. The following month, the line of the San and also that of the Dniester were overrun. On June 22, 1915, Lemberg fell. In July followed a new defeat, the capture of Warsaw in Russian Poland. In August, the Niemen Line was broken, the Germans reached the Berezina, site of Napoleon's brilliant salvation of his retreating army. Pro-Allied historian Renouvin sums it up: the results of the campaign were grave. The Russian armies had abandoned all of Galicia, all of Poland, all of Lithuania. At the center of the front, their retreat exceeded 150 kilometers. They had suffered enormous losses from May to October: 151,000 killed, 683,000 wounded, and 895,000 taken prisoner, that is, nearly half of the combat effectives. La Crise Européenne, page 311. Millions of useless conscripts vegetated in the rear depots, rough louts who could not even be trained because no rifles were available. In such circumstances, could Russia afford Bulgaria as an additional enemy? The Western Allies hadn't accomplished much more. In Artois, despite the fact that they massed 29 Anglo-French divisions against 13 German divisions, and in Champagne, where 39 French infantry divisions faced 17 divisions of the Reich, they had suffered a cruel defeat, almost twice as many dead as the Germans, 250,000 against 140,000, for virtually nothing. Joffre himself had been forced to announce on October 7, 1915, a protracted posture of defensive operations. The Anglo-French disaster at the Dardanelles and the frightful massacre of the Allied troops at Gallipoli at the end of 1915 had made it necessary to find a refuge for the survivors at Salonika. Greek neutrality was violated when the British set up a puppet leader, Venizelos, a cunning Cretan. Things were going from bad to worse for the Allies. The British were making one last official effort to try to hold the Bulgarians to their former neutrality. They had offered the Bulgarians Macedonia as a war bonus, without the knowledge of their Serbian allies, exactly the way French politicians, in August 1939, would secretly concede to the Soviets the right of passage through Poland, when the latter country was categorically opposed to it. To support his proposal, the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, in a speech to the House of Commons, embarked on an astonishing encomium of the Bulgarians. It was October 1, 1915. The Russians were engaged in an operation that was diametrically opposed. After keeping the Allies in the dark up to the last moment, on their own initiative they presented the Bulgarians with an ultimatum, demanding that they break off diplomatic relations with the Germans, an indication of how sincere was the understanding between the Anglo-French and the Russians. One said white, and the other did black. Nothing remained for King Ferdinand of Bulgaria but to send the Tsar of Russia back to his prayers. On October 6, 1915, Mackensen and the Bulgarians attacked Serbia, 300,000 soldiers in all, more than half of them Germans. The 250,000 Serbians, so provocative in 1914, when they had only the unprepared Austrians to face, panicked at the onslaught of the Germans. They appealed for French and British aid, but their allies would not send them so much as a handful of infantrymen. Belgrade fell the first day. Thereafter the Serbians fled towards the Adriatic. It was only after a month of unbroken rout that the Allies decided to send General Sarajevo from Salonika with 80,000 British and French troops towards the last Serbian valley, almost on the border of Greece, but they didn't put to flight so much as a single Macedonian partridge. They became bogged down, then were pushed back. The routed Serbian army was unable to join up with them. The Serbs didn't reach the Adriatic and the famous Albanian coasts that had been promised to everybody until mid-December. Devoured by typhus, the Serbs no longer had either munitions or supplies. Liba! Liba! Bread! Bread, they cried on approaching every hamlet. With them rode the old king, Peter II, in a vehicle drawn by buffaloes. Everywhere they left behind emaciated cadavers. The Italians, who had occupied Valona, drove the last survivors towards the mountains of Greece, because, for a second time, Greek territory had been violated by the Allies at Corfu. There they left Pashik shaking in his beard and already about to betray them. The miserable old fox would soon send emissaries to Switzerland to begin negotiations with the new Austro-Hungarian Emperor, Charles I, and obtain pardon for the Sarajevo double assassination. As a sign of his good faith, he would have the organizer of the crime, Colonel Dmitrievich, shot as a scapegoat. The forces of the Entente would again attempt a Serbian rescue operation in the region of Dediagac. There they would be almost surrounded by the Bulgarians. Germany now crossed the vast area between Berlin and Constantinople at will. Her specialists reinforced the Turkish troops on the near eastern battlefield clear to the threshold of the Suez Canal. It was there, hard by the Red Sea, that the British would now try recruiting new candidates for death, this time among the Arabs. Except for the Romanians, who were delaying their decision, everyone in Europe who could be sent into the fire had already been tossed into the frying pan. Millions of additional soldiers were needed, workers as well. The time had come to recruit foreigners en masse.